The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, we will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. The Small Shop of Me by Renan Bernardo. Olaf sold his left eye. He unplugged it from its socket and laid it over the counter. It fizzled for a second, staring at the buyer with a dead gleam. The buyer, a blind man in his 80s, scanned his thumb on the pay reader and respectfully bowed his head. Olaf dropped the eye into his hand like a coin. The buyer plugged it in and left the shop with a smile, stick under the arm. The shopkeeper's buzz receded, and the stench of compacted trash filled the air. Time to close the shop and go to the drugstore. "I want the usual stuff," Olaf told Brenno, the pharmacist, pressing his thumb on the pay reader. "What happened with the eye, Olaf?" They'd been neighbors, shared beers and bed. But Olaf got distanced from him, as he did from most of his friends since his brother got sick. "Business diversification." "You should take care," Brenno said, giving him the packed serum, breathing off cigar and unresolved issues. He didn't tell Brenno his shop was empty and nothing else to sell but himself. Olaf grabbed the pack and left for the hospital, which is brighter than the shop's alleyway, but instead of noodles and fries, it smells of antiseptic farewells. He entered his brother's bedroom, smiling and leaving the serum over the bedside table, where a nurse had left a lonely, withering sunflower. "You sold your eye," Alan accused him, eyes brimming with tears, arms, legs, and face paralyzed from severe biografting refusal. "You shouldn't do that." Olaf didn't say anything, but yes, he should. Olaf sold his left arm. It was for a boy who wanted a third one. "It's for volleyball," the kid told him as he paid for it. Olaf uncoupled the arm and gaped at his family's tattoo, cartooned versions of him, Alan, and their dead fathers. He tattooed it to honor his fathers months before the world started grafting everyone to contain the fleshly plague. "Any problem, sir?" the boy asked. Olaf shook his memories away. It should have been his right arm, but he was right-handed. "Hope you like tattoos, boy." It was Buying Friday Fest. Olaf sold his right foot, his left kidney, and his ears. He sold four of his ribs, even his heart, which he replaced with clockworks, supposed to function as his cardiovascular system. The last customer of the day was a short woman with golden-plated skin, widow, dead children, dark, fleshly circles around tiring, mirroring eyes. She smelled of the poppies and peonies. He'd have preferred sunflower, but that was not the case. To her, he sold his shop, his family's business, his father's pride, his heritage, all he had left. Olaf had never made so much money in a single day. "I can pay for your medicine and the hospital room for 1 year," Olaf told Alan, exhaling rust and relief, hobbling into his brother's bedroom. It should be enough, but it wasn't. And Olaf didn't have anything else to sell but the legs he used to visit Alan, the eye to see if he was buying the correct serum, and the arm to carry the medicine. "What will you do, Olaf? You sold everything for me, and now you'll see me dying anyway." No, he wouldn't. Olaf met the golden-skinned lady at her shop, her eyes sulking with loneliness and longing. The place had been renovated with lamps, statuettes, and furniture on sale. They all glinted off colors he'd never achieved himself. He placed the packaged medicine on the counter and pushed it toward her, along with a luggage containing all his brother's belongings. She pressed her gilded thumb on Olaf's pay drive. He sold her a friend.
I'm Joanna LaForgia, and this is The Venue by Justin Cole. The marquee read, "One Night Only," in fixed lettering. There was no need to put that on the variable signage and waste space. Everything here was a single performance. No artist ever came back to this venue. That was part of how the venue was so successful. If your favorite artist was playing here, you had to see them for that show run, because you would get no other chance, ever. Every show was a sold-out show at the venue, too. Each and every ticket went for a premium, and people came from around the world to see the shows that were performed there. It was a spectacle. Each and every show was fantastic and pleased everyone in the crowd. There were no negative reviews in the history of the venue. Every single patron was pleased with the performance they attended. I walked by the venue every day on my way to and again on my way from work. I saw who was coming as soon as the sign was updated. I marveled at the names on the sign on a regular basis. I wished I had had the money to purchase a ticket for the three-night extravaganza with Mozart, Pachelbel, and Bach all being featured prominently. But I simply could not afford it. So I listened from outside the building. I have had occasion to want the concert in progress to stop as well. When that happens, I take solace in knowing that the artists will be gone soon and their music with them. Occasionally, they do philosophical, political, and academic lectures, too. Those are not as popular, although they still always sell out. The presentation of the Gettysburg Address was a marvelous educational opportunity, and it was followed by a discussion on the topic of slavery and the economics of national division and secession. I clearly remember seeing that lecture when I was in school. It was the best field trip we ever had. This morning, though, was a completely new endeavor posted to their sign. Something daring that will be a spectacle worth seeing. Something unique. The sign read, "Two nights only, dueling Elvis, old Elvis Presley and young Elvis Presley take the stage together." This will be amazing. My one question is whether the knowledge of what Elvis becomes when he gets old will alter how young Elvis lives his life when they are returned to their own time. I'm guessing that they have that figured out. Either way, I must find a way to afford a ticket.
I'm Warren Keyes, and I'll be reading Flyover Country, written by Garrett Hiley. Grandma used to say it was all a joke until it wasn't funny anymore. That man running for president was a joke until he got elected. The wall was a joke until it was built. California leaving the Union was a joke until they did. The grandson of a dreamer taking a job with ICE was a joke, until a condom broke and the economy tanked and I found myself in a gray uniform with a gray 32-star flag embroidered to my shoulder, a rifle slung across my back, shuffling back and forth with Dirk and Strickland over the gray concrete widow's walk of the wall at 4 a.m, blowing into our hands in the futile attempt to reclaim some feeling from the chill of the desert night. It was a paycheck. Blooners were a joke, too. Dirk was going on about our role in history, Spartans at Thermoplay, he was saying. Roman centurions at the edge of Scotland. Dirk was new. Dirk was young. Dirk was excited to be here. Ming warriors keeping the Mongols at bay. Dirk's team always won trivia night at the Down and Out. After 2 weeks, everybody wanted to throw Dirk over the other side of the wall. The thin gray line between civilization and... Shut up, Strickland grunted, squinting at the horizon. The sun was just starting to bleed over, red and faint, through the filthy air. Hanging above it was a new star, shining like a ruby in the morning twilight. Strickland turned to me with a grin. Blooners! The wall was too steep to scale, too deep to tunnel under, too thick to breach with anything less than a nuclear blast. It was visible from space, spanning the entire border length of the CSA like a cartoon outline. 50 years, $10 trillion. It couldn't do a damn thing to stop a hot air balloon. What do we do? Dirk asked. Nothing, Strickland said, still staring at me, as long as it stays on their side. I stared back. The fuck are you looking at? The old bastard said nothing. He smiled his little cross-burning smile. What if they don't? Dirk was oblivious. Yeah, Esteban, Strickland said. What then? There had never been many blooners over Arizona. Historically, they'd mostly just gone up along the Pacific coast and straight into California. Since New Mexico joined the sanctuary states, they were almost unheard of out here. I had paced this mile of the wall from midnight to 8 every morning for a year, and this was the first one I'd seen. We warned them off, I said, and my name's Stephen, asshole. But what if they don't listen? Dirk asked. If they try to land, we arrest them. That's all. But, Strickland chuckled. Dirk, I sighed. Yeah? Shut the fuck up. We watched the star grow into a pale orb. The balloon was blue, probably almost invisible in full daylight. Against the purpling morning sky, it was a great periwinkle teardrop, swelling as the cold morning breeze blew it north toward us. Something was off. In training, I had seen blooner aircraft of all kinds. Biplanes, triplanes, gyrocopters, a homemade jetpack, an old lawn chair suspended from a swarm of pink Valentine's Day balloons. A canvas Zeppelin, the size of a football field, driven by a dozen ancient diesel engines. Through my binoculars, I could see the envelope was nylon, the seams straight and regular. The basket looked to be a carbon fiber, maybe aluminum with a matte finish. A professional job, which meant sky oats. But sky oats wouldn't make such an amateurish mistake, flying this close, flying a camouflaged balloon at the wrong time of day. I stared at the basket, waiting for a face to peek over the top. I couldn't see anyone. I'm calling it in, Strickland said. I said nothing. Nothing. I wished for the long fabric steering vane on the side of the balloon to flare out. I imagined it turning in front of us like a massive pinball bouncing off an invisible sheet of plexiglass, reflected away to safety. I wished for the breeze to shift. Anything. An electric click echoed across the desert as the loudspeakers came on. Attention, unauthorized aircraft. You are entering CSA airspace. Alter course immediately. You have been warned. I could see now that the balloon was gradually sinking. Maybe it was empty. Sometimes sky oats sent an empty balloon over as a distraction or to deliver drugs. Maybe that basket was full of cocaine. I wished it was full of cocaine. A shot rang out. Another patrol group a mile east of us. They were too far away to have any chance of hitting the damn thing, but what the hell? How often do they get an excuse to shoot these days? Strickland unslung his rifle and took aim. I grabbed the muzzle. What the fuck do you think you're doing? Nothing, he said, adjusting his sight. Yet. Another shot from the west. I jumped. Strickland laughed.
Muy debido, eh, hombre?
Let's go unless you want to lose a finger. I gambled. I wrenched the gun out of his hands. He reached after it, tried and failed to pry it back from me. For a moment, I could see just how old he was. The balloon drifted silently overhead. With a deafening bang, the propane tank over the basket burst wide. The envelope caught instantly, flames slithering up the nylon like rattlesnakes from under a rock, leaving trails of bubbling black filament in their wake. The basket came loose, dropped to the ground below with the screeching crunch of twisted metal. I got it! Strickland and I turned to see Dirk holding his rifle up in triumph. One shot! His face fell. We all looked down at the basket, laying on its side in the dirt. Broken, burning bodies had spilled from its mouth to the ground, a dozen at least, like grains of rice from a sack. Children. Every last one of them.
Hi, I'm Carrie Lawson, and I'll be reading Perchance to Dream by Forrest Brazil. Monday. Tell me your secret, I said. Mara smiled. I don't sleep, she said. Sun streamed through the windows of the library, turning her hair to fire. We're college students, I pointed out, thumping my textbook shut. None of us sleep, but you're the one with the good grades. Mara regarded me calculatingly for a moment and then reached into her purse and drew out a small white bottle. Sleep pills. I bought them on the internet. They're not totally legal here. And she tucked the bottle away again with a deft motion of her hand. Sleeping pills help you study? Not sleeping pills, dum-dum. Sleep pills. She enunciated with wide-stretched cheeks. One caplet contains 8 hours of rest, all the benefits of a refreshing night with none of the time commitment. So they're caffeine pills. No, it's nothing like that. They make the stuff from some hormone. It's literally sleep in a bottle. That can't be healthy, I said. She shrugged, letting out a small cackle. Well, I haven't been to bed in 6 weeks, and I feel great. I'm so far ahead on my classes. I stared at her. Her eyes looked a little sunken and her cheeks a bit drawn, but that could have just been the late afternoon shadows. If you're so far ahead, you can quiz me, I said finally. Wednesday. I caught up with Mara in the quadrangle. She was walking a little more rapidly than usual, her book bag whacking against the backs of her legs. Hey, I said a bit out of breath. Are you still not sleeping? She flinched at the sound of my voice, half turned and laughed. Who needs sleep? She said. I'm the most productive I've ever been. I finished all my homework for the semester, and now I'm working on grad school applications. Do you think I should learn Chinese? I lengthened my steps as she continued to hurry along. Don't you miss, you know, being asleep? I asked. Just the fundamental experience of it. No, she said, then after a pause. I miss dreaming, a little bit. She turned a corner abruptly and disappeared. Friday. You look terrible, I said frankly. We sat with our backs against the stairwell in the student commons, sharing almonds out of a bag. Mara's eyes were red and puffy. She glanced constantly from side to side like a jittery forest creature, huddling close against me as she scrabbled in the bag. I think I'm going to quit the pills, she said, or at least cut back. Save them for a few all-nighters. I thought not sleeping was the greatest thing ever, I said. The thing is, said Mara, when you don't sleep, your dreams come out to play. I thought about this for a minute. Like daydreams? I asked. All kinds, she said. Nightmares, mostly. They don't stay in my head anymore. They follow me around on paw feet and claw feet. You're hallucinating, I said. Of course, she agreed. She fumbled in her purse and came up with a single white capsule. She sliced it in half with her thumb, popped one piece in her mouth, and held out the rest to me. Catnap? Monday. Mara didn't show up to her lecture class on Monday morning. She didn't answer her phone, and none of her roommates had seen her in more than a day. I got scared and called campus police. They found her, at the bottom of a ravine behind the practice fields. Dew had soaked her hoodie and washed the dark stains from her head. The police say she jumped, and that given the amount of unidentifiable junk in her bloodstream, she probably never felt a thing. At the top of the ravine, in the loose gravel, were tracks of some kind. Paw prints. The police don't know what she thought she was running from. Neither do I. But I've dreamt about it.
Hello, I'm Robbie Merritt. This story is called The Missionary by Tygan Shelton. I was caught almost as soon as I arrived in Bavah. I knew my eventual arrest was certain, but I had hoped to win a few converts first. But the Bavahs began mocking me as soon as I started singing the name of the one musician. And when I declared that there were no other gods but he, their jeers became angry. They bound me and marched me to the temple palace. The Va sat high on his throne. His single black braid flowed to the wooden staff in his right hand. His right arm was painted the light blue of life, his left arm the black of death. His only clothing was a golden skirt and jeweled sandals, but rings of gold and obsidian adorned his fingers. I silently prayed that I might touch the Va's heart. After all, there are miracles every day in the grand chorus of the musician. Inexplicably, the Va smiled. I was hoping the singers would come. I was prepared to die for the musician. I was not prepared for this. You were? The Va laughed. Indeed, I have prayed to my father for many months that you would come teach my people. Ignoring this theological contradiction, I was amazed. The musician's name be praised. The Va's face grew stern. You know better than I, singer, that your religion is more advanced than ours. Ours has too many gods. Gods of fertility, war, bureaucracy. Even I cannot remember them all. And a new one every generation. Too many sacrifices and lavish temples. It was good for our ancestors, but it is too much for us. But you, singer, you worship a single, simple God, one of love and peace. He does not require monuments or blood, no. He asked for love, decency, labor. You need but a simple chapel to worship him. He sighed heavily. Yes, singer, I prefer your religion. I want my people to become as devout as you are. My heart leapt. But a thought crossed my mind. Pardon me, Va, but I am surprised at your devotion. Will you not miss being worshipped? At this, the Va slammed his staff down. Whoever asked me if I wanted to be God? The marble floor shook, and I cowered in spite of myself. He turned away, then slowly turned back, his face once again calm. It is true, many envy me. Endless wealth, my every need met. My word is obeyed with haste and exactness. I am adored as the only being standing between prosperity and destruction. But in that, I am worse off than a slave. I must in all things and at all times act as the God my people expect. They deserve no less, but I in turn must sacrifice my whole life. So you see why I long for the day I am no longer needed. I did see. It wasn't exactly the conversion I had hoped for, but it could lead to true conversion across the whole land of Bavah. As I considered how to respond, a horn blew. Guard ran in and fell on his face. Son of heaven, hear our prayer. The Remarians' warships have been sighted and will arrive in minutes. We have been caught completely off guard. Our navy is across the sea, and our army is away in the east. Our garrison is vastly outnumbered. Without you, great Vaa, we face certain death. The Vaa's face paled, and his eyes lost focus. Despite the urgency, he was still for half a minute. Finally, his eyes narrowed. He turned to me and sadly smiled. Singer, it seems that the conversion you dream of must be delayed. I do not think my people will be quick to convert after today's slaughter. He stood up to follow the guard. No, I raised my hand. But Vaa, don't you see, this could be it. This could be the moment your nation gains their faith. Command your people to pray to the great musician. You yourself, pray to him. Surely he will save you. This is your chance to save your people, both in body and soul. He paused. Singer, perhaps you are right. Perhaps your musician could save us. But I cannot afford to bet the lives of my people on a god of whom I am not yet certain. I hope you understand. But what... I grew silent as he hurried away. I followed him through the halls. No guards bothered to stop me. We reached the balcony, and I gasped as I saw dozens of ships with blood-red sails entering the harbor.
When they saw the Vaa above them, the crowds erupted into shouted prayers. These turned into screams as the first fiery arrows flew from the nearest ships. In my heart, I sang a quick but poignant song that the musician would sing to the heart of the Vaa, that the Vaa might sing to him and save his people. But the Vaa did not kneel. Instead, he lifted his hands high above his head. The crowd was silenced and dropped to its knees. Suddenly, the hands erupted into hot blue flames. I instinctively dropped to the ground and covered my face. Through my fingers, I peered at the Vaa. Had the Remarians hit him from so far away? But no. He stood powerfully, and the fire from his hands rose high into the sky, arced across the city to the harbor, and struck the first ship. It caught fire at once, and now the screams came from the men on board. He moved his hands, and the fiery arc moved from vessel to vessel until all that remained of the fleet was embers and a few men who had leapt from their ships before they too caught fire. The crowd rose to its feet, and I could barely hear for the shouts of praise. The Vaa looked at me, and I somehow heard, "I apologize, singer. I believe your conversion will have to wait."
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.